Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello. In 1976, tonight's guest, Dr. Jacob Israel Lieberman, experienced a miraculous and spontaneous healing of his eyesight. Originally trained as an optometrist and vision scientist, that experience transformed Dr. Lieberman's work and his life. Today, he's an internationally respected public speaker, author, and pioneer in the fields of light, vision, colour, and consciousness. His first book, Light, Medicine of the Future, established him as one of the world's leading authorities on light and colour therapy. And inspired by the recovery of his vision, his second book, Take Off Your Glasses and See, a mind-body approach to expanding your eyesight and insight, offered a radical new approach to natural vision improvement. Dr. Jacob Lieberman joins me tonight to discuss his latest book, Luminous Life, How the Science of Light Unlocks the Art of Living, which illuminates the connection between light, vision, and consciousness, and shows how the luminous intelligence that we call light effortlessly guides us towards health, contentment, and a life filled with purpose. Dr. Jacob Lieberman, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you so much for having me as your guest.
It's our pleasure too. Now, I want to start at the beginning of your extraordinary journey when early in your optometric career, you experienced a sudden, significant and permanent improvement in your vision. So tell us a little bit about that experience.
You know, when I went into practice in the vision care field, it became immediately obvious to me that everyone's vision seemed to be deteriorating. Very few people were born with eyesight difficulties. Yet, as I looked around, most of the people I saw were wearing glasses or having to wear contact lenses. And since I had been wearing glasses at that time for several years and my eyesight kept getting worse, I wondered why it was in the vision care field that a problem continues to get worse, but we keep treating it with the same solution. Eye doctors didn't seem to question the fact that they kept giving glasses to their patients and their eyes just continually worsened. And so I started looking at the way glasses were prescribed, and I started investigating preventive vision care and vision training and different things that I could do, because I needed to experiment on myself to see, was this really possible before I began working with others? And so I did a series of different things, and all of them changed incrementally. But then in 1976, I had a rather profound experience. I was sitting and meditating one day, which I had done for about 5 years at the time, and something unusual occurred. You know, normally when you're in meditation, you're aware of your breath, or maybe you're repeating a mantra or noticing something in your mind's eye. Well, somewhere in the process of my meditation, I seemed to have lost all sense of self. There just seemed to be a sense of spacious clarity. My eyes were closed, but I had a sense that I could see myself clearly in the room that I was sitting in. And there was a sense that everything in life was clear. I don't know how to describe that other than that. When I opened my eyes after this meditative experience, I noticed that my eyesight in the actual world with eyes open was totally clear. It was such a shocking shift for me that I actually got in my car with the eyeglasses that I normally wore and my license said that I had to wear on the seat next to me, I drove to my office. I checked my eyesight on a series of eye charts that I had never looked at before. And lo and behold, I was seeing 300% better than I was just a little while earlier before I entered this state of meditation. It was such a shocking realization that I decided to actually examine my eyes to see if there was a change in prescription, because what I learned in school was that as the eyes progressively got worse, the prescription would get stronger. Well, all of a sudden, I'm seeing 300% better. Perhaps my eyesight and my prescription has lessened or maybe disappeared altogether. I examine myself, and when I finish the exam, even though I can't see what the lens power is in the device, I come out from behind my instruments, I look at the device that I use, and I'm shocked to discover that the prescription in the device is almost identical to that which is in my glasses. In other words, I was experiencing a 300% improvement in eyesight with no change to my eyes. Now, at that point, I didn't know whether to be excited or terrified. I mean, I really had no idea what had occurred here, and all my mind could do was think of the worst case scenario. I have a brain tumor, or God forbid, something else, because this was not supposed to happen. I had never heard of anything like this, and I was led to believe this was impossible. Now, if something like that occurred for a matter of minutes, that would be very interesting. If it occurred for a day, you'd say, oh my God, this is miraculous. Well, this shift that occurred in 1976 has now remained for 42 years. And I'm 70 and a half right now, and I still wear no glasses for distance and no glasses for reading. When I go to the eye doctor, which I do every year, I still show significant amounts of astigmatism, which means I shouldn't be able to see well, but I do. I pass all my driver's tests. My eye doctors are sort of amazed. So the interesting thing about this experience is not just the fact that I see well, even though my eyes show that they need a fairly strong prescription, but this happened instantaneously. I didn't do anything to make this happen. And so that brings up a very, very interesting point, because the universe, our bodies, Mother Nature, in fact, everything that exists follows a law called the law of parsimony. The law of parsimony is essentially the law of efficiency. In other words, how do you get the most with the least effort? And when we look at the universe, the workings of the body, the workings of Mother Nature, we see the law of parsimony working out in front of our eyes. Because our bodies function effortlessly, so do the planets revolving around the sun, and so on. So what's interesting is this shift occurred without any effort, without any trying, without exercising, without repetition. And that goes against pretty much everything we've been led to believe, because even though the body functions without effort, and so does Mother Nature, we have all been conditioned to believe that we have to make things work out, that we have to make things happen, that we have to work at things. And so this process really reflected to me something very, very deep having to do with life. And that is that maybe all of these things that we have learned about working hard on life, about stressing ourselves out, about making things happen, maybe things don't actually work this way. And so that set me on a course over the last 42 years of looking for truth beyond opinion. In other words, aside from what we think is going on, our concepts, our theories, and our beliefs, what is the underlying unchanging truth that the Bible speaks of that supposedly sets you free? And is that truth what impacted my vision and what might also be called a spontaneous remission for individuals who have been diagnosed with serious illnesses, and then those illnesses seem to go away in the same way they came? I don't know the answers to these questions, but I have been investigating this for many, many years, and I've seen some rather profound things and openings, not only in my own life, but in the probably 45,000 individuals I've had the pleasure of working with. And it has led me to realize that we understand very little about life and about what we call mind and what we call consciousness. So these pieces have become sort of corner posts of my life, cornerstones.
Some might also say that you were carrying an intention. I mean, you were making incremental changes, as you said. You were doing a lot of research. But could it have been as simple as you had the intention?
Well, the only thing that, you know, that was happening in my life at that point is that I felt excited about looking for something that was rather obvious to me, but seemingly forgotten about by most of my colleagues. And it was really an open-ended experiment to see, is there something possible here that I'm not aware of, that the textbooks haven't really written about? Interestingly enough, the way this change occurred in me, I would have never anticipated, because the change that occurred didn't impact my physical being. In other words, the entire shift occurred in something else, but not in my eyes, not in my body. And so it also allowed me to realize that the shifts that often we search for in our bodies may actually occur in a different aspect of our humanity. And that's something that I have looked at very, very deeply in terms of when we think of ourselves, we think of ourselves as body, we think of ourselves as mind, and we often think of ourselves as spirit. But spirit is something that we don't really consider as something so much tangible. And so we think a lot of these changes occur in what we call mind. I have been looking at this through my own direct experience for many, many years, and I've uncovered some very interesting aspects there that I think are the key to certain aspects of our freedom, are key to being successful at living, not just at making money or developing a significant reputation or being a rock star, but something about the quality of our lives, which is what's really become important to me, not just our health, but our happiness as well, our contentment.
I want to come back to that probably after our break, because much of what you're referring to now is revealed in your latest book. For now, I just want to go back to that time. And you developed since then numerous light and vision therapy instruments, including the first FDA-cleared medical device to significantly improve visual performance. How did you go from that experience to developing a device that works for other people? I mean, you know, what is that
you know
device?
It's interesting, when you think of a device, you think of something that you use for exercise. Mm-hmm. But interestingly enough, this device the protocol was for people to do five 90-second experiences each day, 6 days a week. And what we discovered after they did it for 3 weeks is not only were there significant changes in a whole array of areas, from eyesight to depth perception to aiming, tracking, focusing, teaming, reading efficiency, comprehension, and many other areas as well. But what was really fascinating is that when people stopped using the device, their improvement continued. In other words, it was the device was not exercising something that required continual exercise. It was improving the acuity of our awareness. It was allowing us to see something or to experience something in a new way, and that shift, that epiphany, caused a total transformation in the wiring of our brains.
You know, many years ago, I read a book called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, and one of the reports in there was of a doctor, I don't know what nationality he was, Romanian or Bulgarian or something, but he was teaching blind people how to see. And the way he was doing it, he was getting them, he was using colored sheets, and getting them to use their fingertips over the colored sheets. And the actual, each color seemed to have, some kind of sensation to it, a feel, stickiness, slipperiness, etc. And people began to identify colors, and some of them actually began to see.
Right.
Are you familiar with that?
I am familiar with that. I read that book many, many years ago, and perhaps
I'd like to ask you that question again after the break. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest today is Dr. Jacob Lieberman, who's a pioneer in the fields of light, vision, color, and consciousness. And we're discussing his latest book, Luminous Life, How the Science of Light Unlocks the Art of Living. We'll be back in a few moments.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
Change and growth are part of natural life and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, Dr. Jacob Lieberman. Would you like to finish what you were going to say about that particular book?
Yeah, I read that book many, many, many years ago and found that, rather fascinating. And, when you speak about these individuals placing their hands over a color sheet and feeling differences between them, you know that if you place both of the palms of your hand opposite each other, you know, within 2 to 3 inches of each other and close your eyes, you can actually feel like a subtle vibration or even a temperature shift because of the biofield, the energetic field that surrounds the body. Well, everything has a vibrational fingerprint. So when you think of color, color is something that is a phenomenon that we perceive because of the design of our perceptual apparatus, and that's different for a dog or a bee or a dolphin or a snake. Each different type of being perceives what we call life differently depending on the type of perceptual apparatus they have and something we call consciousness. So color is not something out in the world. It's actually something we experience within our own mind, our own consciousness. What is out in the world is the vibrational foundation of those perceptions. So when you think of a color, what's actually there are different rates of vibration, different types of energy that are part of the spectrum of energy we call the electromagnetic spectrum, the energy that comes off the sun. We are impacted differently by each of these energies. While some of them we perceive as colors, some of them we perceive as smells or as sounds or as tastes. Once we begin to discern the subtle differences between those energetic foundations, we begin to see in a different way. We may not be seeing visually via our eyes, but we need to realize something. Every cell in the body, without exception, has photodetectors. It literally has eyes that are able to detect and respond to the energy known as light. Why is that important? That is what keeps every cell in the body continually upgrading its software so that we as an individual or a bear in the forest or a tree stays in a harmonious relationship with Mother Nature. And so what this scientist was doing was basically taking individuals whose eyes didn't function appropriately and give them the experience of uncovering a totally different set of eyes, a different way of sensing life. And those who were able to uncover those particular senses all of a sudden had a sixth sense or a seventh sense, which is very, very common in creatures in the wild. I mean, if you look in 2004, 2005, there was a very significant tsunami that hit Southeast Asia. About 3 days before the tsunami hit, all of the wild animals were screaming and howling as if they were trying to communicate, you know, some danger that was coming. And then they started running toward the highest hills and mountains to get away from it. Interestingly enough, very few, if any, wild animals perished in that disaster. Yet 150,000 humans and most domesticated animals perished. They couldn't seem to get away. They couldn't seem to sense what was going on. And yet, if you look at human beings, we have the exact same mechanisms as creatures of the wild in terms of detecting that which is not visible. The only difference is that we have been led to believe not to trust the guidance that we sense but cannot see, and instead to trust the ideas of the mind. And so that's been a great deal of my work, because when people believe they see with their eyes, I have not found that a great deal of change can occur. And when they try to change their minds, it's almost like a dog chasing its tail. It changes one thing and then something else spurts up. If we are fortunate enough to realize that we are all aware of mental activity, we are all aware when thinking is happening, when worrying is happening. And the reason we are aware is because our essence, our actual true essence, is something that is observing everything all the time. Once we begin to identify with that noticer, then possibilities open up that we couldn't even begin to imagine.
So your work seems to be really looking at light and how we've not grasped, you know, the significance of light in our lives. And that it's when we are looking at something, when we are seeing something. I mean, you think about light, it's, you know, we talk about light in the Bible. Throughout history, people have had an incredible connection to light, and there are many myths and stories around light. Light is really important. We think it's because, you know, it allows us to see what's in front of us, but in fact, it's far more significant than that. What is the true significance of light?
Well, first of all, you bring up a very big question, but I'll do my best to summarize it. If you look at things from a religious perspective, the Bible speaks of a creative force, and it calls this creative force God. And then it describes God as being omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, all-powerful, all-knowing, and everywhere at the same time. And then it goes on to make a very bold statement. It says, God is light. If you look at spiritual texts throughout history, they describe consciousness, which is also the creative force, but spoken about in a different way. And they speak of consciousness as light. If you speak to a scientist, especially those involved in quantum mechanics, which is based on large degree on light, they will tell you that the fundamental or foundational energy upon which everything emerges, from where life emerges, is light. And this is why the renowned theoretical quantum physicist David Bohm said, all matter is frozen light. Everything that we see as solid is actually light energy that has been transmuted into matter. So whether you're looking at things religiously, spiritually, scientifically, they all take you to the same point of origin. Light is the foundation, and maybe this is why the Bible states in the beginning, let there be light. In my first book in 1991, Light Medicine of the Future, I made a bold statement. I said that the primary purpose of light was to bring us into a state of oneness with the cosmos. And many of my colleagues said, that's just crazy. Where did you come up with that? I found it interesting. October 2nd, I believe, of 2017, I opened up my computer one morning, and there on the front page of CNN, it said that the Nobel Prize for Medicine and Physiology had just been awarded to three U.S. scientists who had discovered the molecular basis by which all the cells in our body and in an animal's body and in a plant's body are literally continually adjusting themselves to the light and dark cycle so that we are in a harmonious relationship with life. And then they gave the example. They said, you know, when you travel from the U.S. to the U.K., for instance, you get there and you feel out of sorts. And they say, oh, that's just jet lag. Your body is on New York or California time, but here you are in London. Well, you wait a matter of days and you notice that you're eating at unusual times of the day. You seem to be using the bathroom at times you normally wouldn't. You fall asleep during the day and wake up during the night. And sometimes you even feel like you're going to come down with something because your body's clock and Mother Nature's clock in London are just not synchronized. Fortunately, we adjust and then we feel just fine. That's the impact of short-term jet lag, short-term being out of synchronicity with Mother Nature. What I've noticed in my years in the medical and scientific field is that most human beings are chronically jet lag, even though they've never gone to the airport. And that is because rather than following Mother Nature's guidance in terms of when we awaken, when we sleep, and so on, we live our life according to ideas or concepts. And concepts are not reality. And so what happens after a while is it gets dark at 8 or 9 in the evening, but we go to bed at 1 in the morning. We begin using our computers late at night, which basically the light coming off the computers or our cell phones tell our body it's one time of the day, when it's in actuality another time of the day. If you look from a satellite onto the city of London, for instance, you'll notice it never gets dark. It's light 24 hours a day. If you look at individuals who live in areas where it never gets dark, where the street lights are always on, you find a much higher incidence of cancers and other chronic illnesses because of something called light pollution. On the other hand, if you have too little light because you're living in Oslo and it's you only getting an hours of daylight, you'll notice depression, you'll notice alcoholism, you'll notice suicides, you'll notice excessive drug use, and many other kinds of things. So the body is continually being guided by this energy, this invisible energy that we call light, and it is being picked up by the trillions of cells in our body. And that is what's causing our cells to speed up, to slow down, to replicate, to use more energy, to use less energy. In fact, 2/3 of the energy that is produced by our cells to run every function of the body, 2/3 of that comes directly from the ingestion of light, only 1/3 from the ingestion of food. So that gives you a sense of how important light is in our daily lives, in our health, in our happiness, in every aspect of our wellness.
Well, we hear a lot about breatharians, people who allegedly do not eat food at all, but rather they say they live on light. Is that truly possible, that somebody could literally live on light?
Well, there's a wonderful documentary that was won a series of awards a couple of years ago. I think it was called And There Was Light. It was produced by a wonderful filmmaker in Austria named Peter Straubinger. People should look that up. I think it's called And There Was Light. And it has a tremendous amount of science in this documentary and speaks directly to the question that you have, is it possible? So now I've shared with you the fact that in the book, I speak about a rather interesting case of a Swami in India who has supposedly not eaten in a very long period of time. And I speak about all the medical documentation that has been done on him by the highest levels of science, scientific and medical investigators where he lives. And this documentary also mentions cases, but I'll share with you a personal experience. In 1994, I went to Australia and because I was doing an event in Adelaide, Australia, my host picked me up. To make a very long story short, he was one of those people that you just spoke about who claimed he hadn't eaten in a year. I was living in his house with two other people who went through the same process, and I was there with them for 3 to 4 days, and there wasn't a thing in their refrigerator. I never saw them eat, and they had a tremendous amount of energy. When I did the weekend workshop there, I met another 18 people who claimed to not be eating, to be living on light. I then spent the next couple of months in Perth, Australia. I was so interested in this because I'd heard about this, but I just couldn't believe it. I asked them to send me the protocol. What did they do? How did they do it? Because I wanted to see, is there any truth to this? To make a long story short, I didn't eat for 9 weeks. And what I discovered was rather fascinating, that yes, we can exist quite well without consuming food. And in fact, I wasn't even having that much water, maybe 3 to 4 cups of water a day. I haven't done this for many years. I do not recommend it for anyone. For me, it was an experiment. I needed to find out, is there some truth to this? And the only way I was going to find out was not through someone else's experience, but by my own experience. So what I discovered is, yes, there is something to this. I try to speak about this to some degree in the book. Peter Straubinger's documentary goes into a lot more depth. I think it's a very interesting topic. Whether it is applicable for most of our lives is a whole different question. For me, I love eating. It's part of the culture I grew up in. It's a time to connect with others. And so, you know, one of my favorite expressions is until we eat again. But in terms of your question, I think that there is something really there, and I think it will become much clearer in the next 10 or 15 years because there is an explosion occurring all over the world having to do with light. Its therapeutic benefits, its biological impact, and how literally we can't get by without it.
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with internationally respected speaker, author, and vision scientist, Dr. Jacob Lieberman, about his groundbreaking new book, Luminous Life, How the Science of Light Unlocks the Art of Living, which claims that light is the key to optimal health, contentment, and a life filled with purpose. We'll be back with more from Dr. Lieberman after this break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Dr. Jacob Lieberman, your initial research revealed that most of us are not looking where we think we're looking. Our mind's eye is not focused on the same location as our physical eyes. And you say that this is why presence is so rare. Say more about that.
You know, I don't know if our listeners have ever studied or are familiar with a science called neuro-linguistic programming, NLP. And what that science had discovered many, many years ago is when we are consciously thinking about something, searching for information in the file cabinets of our mind, if you will, our eyes move in a certain direction, could be up and left, up and right, down and right, down and left, straight ahead. And the eye movement literally makes it possible to access those memories, those files. And so very often when people are driving and they're thinking about the golf course or something else, unbeknownst to them, their eyes look away from the road, all of a sudden they have a rear-end collision, and when the police officer says, "What happened here?" the person says, "I have no idea," because they weren't there. One of the things that you'll notice when you're speaking with people is that they're often thinking about something. Their face is looking at you, but sometimes their eyes are looking up or down. One of the things that I started looking at in the early 70s when I was working with kids that were having difficulties in school, and specifically a lot of high-level professional and Olympic athletes, I was looking at how could I help them to optimize their game, whether their game was in the area of learning or in the area of playing golf or bowling or something else. And so I started evaluating these people to see what each of their eyes were doing and how their eyes were working together while they were reading, writing, playing ball, and so on. And I discovered something fascinating. Only about 30% of the people that I evaluated were their eyes and their mind focused on the same place at the same time. 70% of the people thought they were looking one place, but their eyes were actually looking a little closer to them or a little further away, which made it almost impossible for them to be totally there. It also really interfered with their sense of time and space. They felt like they had more time or not enough time, or they had a tendency to get early, to be early for things a lot of the time, or to run late all of the time, or they found themselves feeling like they were driving at a good distance from the car in front of them, but yet the person in the passenger seat kept saying, "Why are you tailgating them?" So what I began noticing is that when we are looking at something, unless there's a way for the person to actually see where their eyes are looking, there is merely an assumption that where I think I'm looking and where I'm actually looking, we assume they're the same place. Most of the time, they're not. And so in the book, I give a very simple technique with a string and some beads that people can do at home at no cost at all, that allows them to notice when they're looking at something, are their eyes focused on the same place, or are their eyes looking a little closer to them or a little further away? And does that relate to maybe they're trying too hard they're creating too much stress. So having that feedback allows people to see things that they've never seen before, and that awareness is often curative. One of the things that I noticed is that we've all been conditioned to think about everything, and we are led to believe that this is a good thing. But so often our thinking is really a fancy word for worrying. So much of our internal dialogue is an inner rehearsal trying to ensure that things come out a certain way. Kids do this in school. Athletes do this while they're playing ball and competing. What I noticed in the 70s is that when we start thinking or trying, there's a tendency to hold our breath. And when the breath is held, one's field of vision begins to collapse, and one's sense of flow begins to segment. And so rather than being in a state where they're just flowing with whatever comes up, their actions, their physical response becomes very segmented, and they're not able to respond at their maximum potential. And so one of the things I discovered in terms of presence is when people are trying too hard, their eyes typically overconverge. They look closer to them than they think they're looking. One, because they're trying hard. Two, because they're holding their breath. And when that happens, what we call presence is exceedingly difficult to experience. Another thing that's very, very interesting is that, you know, you spoke about colors and light before. I discovered in the late 70s that people were very comfortable with certain colors and very uncomfortable with others. And I didn't know why that was, because I was led to believe that every color has a certain effect. Well, I did not find that that was actually true. What I found is that because colors are different vibrations, how someone responds to color tells me the vibrations that make up their life experience, the vibrations they're comfortable and receptive to, and those vibrations or experiences that they recoil from. And I found a direct experience between the colors somebody liked and the experiences in their life they felt safe and at home with, while the colors they didn't like reflected the experiences in life that they had an allergic reaction to, that triggered them emotionally, that chronically created stress in their life. And when they were able to become comfortable with the colors that were uncomfortable prior to that, they started becoming desensitized to the psycho-emotional triggers that chronically created a lack of ease in their life, and often physical disease. And so over the years, I've developed different light therapy units, and now we have a little kit that people use at home that allows them to notice how they respond to colors and how to utilize colors to desensitize from these unresolved emotional triggers. And I mention this because in the book, I allow the reader to actually do an experiment with themselves to experience this directly and to see how it might be impacting their life. So the whole idea of the book is really to improve the acuity of awareness. It's not so much about improving your eyesight. It's about expanding how much we are aware of, because with greater awareness comes greater sense of wellness in life. We see more, we respond more fully, and we can begin living life without a net, without having to have an insurance policy all the time.
You spoke earlier about breathing and how There seems to be a connection between breathing and our ability to see our vision. What I'm hearing you say is that, you know, the things that we think are separate, our sense of smell, our sense of taste, our, you know, our sense of sight, our breathing, etc., there is no separation between any of them, and everything impacts everything else.
That's correct.
So
that's absolutely correct.
So this is why if we improve our vision or if we improve our breathing, we can improve other aspects of our life as well.
Yeah, you know, the reason that our breathing is impacted is because we've all been conditioned to believe we have to work hard, we have to think ahead, we have to make things happen. And every time that we take a system that is designed to function without effort, and we try to make it do something, we interfere with it. And the greatest place, the clearest barometer of that interference is that the moment we do that, the breathing is constricted. And the body lives on oxygen and light. And when that oxygen is not there, every function starts to constrict. This is why we get so frightened when we find it difficult to breathe. Most of us are suffering from a deficiency of oxygen because we breathe in a very shallow manner, because we're so stressed from working so hard, trying so hard, and our continual habituation to thinking excessively, to worrying about life, rather than living life.
Do you have any tips to offer us before we close the show that can help our listeners improve their vision or use color or improve their breathing at home to begin this journey that you've taken?
If they're interested in color, you know, after looking at the example I speak about in the book, they might want to visit my website, jacoblieberman.org, O-R-G, and look up something called the Spectral Receptivity System 3, the SRS-3, which is a very affordable little kit that allows them to do these things at home. In terms of a quick something that people can do. Everyone is aware of meditation, but most people can't sit for 20 minutes and meditate. Their life is just too busy. So in the book, I share with people to do a little 1 minute or 30 second meditation. So every time you have to use the restroom and you're sitting there, close your eyes and just notice how your body is continually expanding and contracting. Don't try to breathe. Don't try to do anything. Just notice how your body expands and contracts for as long as you're sitting there. Maybe take 30 seconds to do that before and after you eat, before you get out of bed in the morning, and before you close your eyes to go to sleep at night. When you're driving your car, maybe between one traffic signal and the next, you'll just notice how your body is expanding and contracting. Merely awareness of the breath allows you to notice when the breath is constricted. And once that's noticing, that you notice that, it starts up automatically. So it's just about fine-tuning our awareness. I think the book has many, many tips for people who are listening today. And I hope this has been helpful.
Well, the book certainly is fascinating, and I'm also fascinated by your book, Light Medicine of the Future, which was written quite a long time ago, as you said, I think in the early 90s.
And
what we're discovering now is how light is being used in treatment for all kinds of things. So it's an absolutely fascinating topic, and I wish we had longer to speak, but I'm afraid we're out of time now. So thank you so much for joining us.
I hope we can do it again.
I hope so too. Luminous Life, How the Science of Light Unlocks the Art of Living, is published by New World Library and can be found at most major bookstores and online outlets. And for more information about Dr. Jacob Lieberman, his books and his work, visit jacoblieberman.org. And do check out Light, Medicine of the Future. I'm certainly going to. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.